From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Leslie Klinger knows the stories of Arthur Conan Doyle better than almost anyone, and of all the Sherlock Holmes stories he's read and written about, The Adventure of the Blue Carbuncle is his favorite. It's the only Holmes story set in the Christmas season, but that's not why Klinger likes it.
To me, it's the combination of a very clever mystery, brilliant deductions by Holmes, and a truly warm demonstration of the friendship between Holmes and Watson.
Today in the program, we're talking about the Blue Carbuncle, and here's the spoiler: Holmes solves the case. It's our latest partnership with Plan B Theater Company. We're presenting a radio play of that story later this month, and today we're giving you a preview. Sherlock Holmes and radio, after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today we're talking about a Christmas story. Not just any Christmas story. This one features a Christmas goose, a stolen jewel, and London's most famous detective, Sherlock Holmes. The Adventure of the Blue Carbuncle is the only Sherlock Holmes story set in the Christmas season, but as the poet Christopher Morley put it, it is a Christmas story without slush. Today we're talking about The Adventure of the Blue Carbuncle with Leslie Klinger. He's an expert on Sherlock Holmes. We're collaborating with Salt Lake's Plan B Theater Company to produce a radio drama of this story later this month. We'll be giving you the details about that as we go along. Today, we're also giving you a taste of the play and discussing the story's appeal as well. Let me introduce Leslie Klinger. He's an expert on two icons of the Victorian era, Sherlock Holmes and Dracula. He's written some 20 books on Holmes, including the three-volume set, The New Annotated Sherlock Holmes. And he's joining us today from the studios of UCLA in Los Angeles. Leslie Klinger, welcome back to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
So, The Adventure of the Blue Carbuncle, Leslie Klinger, you've talked about this as being your favorite story.
Yes.
Why?
Well, it's a combination of elements. First of all, the story itself is a clever mystery. The idea, we don't want to give too much away, but the idea that the Blue Carbuncle is discovered in a very unusual place. There is a wonderful scene of deduction, one of the classic scenes of Holmes making something out of nothing. And then I think the friendship that's on display here. There's a good deal of Holmes and Watson doing things together, and we really see how close they are. And as you mentioned at the top, this is one of the first stories, and it's really one of the first stories to develop that friendship.
When did the story first sort of come to Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, do we know?
Well, he turned out a series of 12 stories in a very short period of time. So I don't know whether he had thought of some of the ideas before. This is in 1891, in the spring of 1891, that he very quickly produced the stories later collected as The Adventures for the Strand Magazine.
And it was in Philadelphia, the Philadelphia Inquirer, too. This was what, 18?
A number of American newspapers, 1891. Yes, a number of American newspapers reprinted the stories, not always paying copyright royalties.
And this is how a lot of the original stories or some of these stories came to a lot of people at first, was in magazines or newspapers?
Absolutely. This is, of course, before television and radio, unfortunately. There was a rising reading public in the Victorian age. The Strand Magazine was a brand new magazine. George Newnes had decided to copy the success of some American publishers and wanted to do a magazine that featured pictures on at least every other page. The idea that he had was to make the magazine something that people could take with them on the train and read a complete story. The novels, of course, had been serialized in newspapers and magazines for a long time, Dickens, of course, being very popular. Mm. But the idea of having self-contained short stories was relatively new.
So Watson points out in this story pretty early on that no crime had actually been committed, at least not that he knew about, and that no harm had been done. And it's interesting to note, because you have, too, that a lot of Holmes cases didn't really start with a crime, and it's Holmes preventing something before it becomes a crime. Is this sort of a theme that you get in Doyle's work?
Yes. In many ways, it's quite different from the modern criminal procedural things that we're used to seeing on television or that we read even in modern mystery novels, which almost always feature murder. Or sort of very high-tech robbery. Many of the Sherlock Holmes stories are focused differently. There's very few murders. There are certainly some blackmail cases and robberies, but in many cases, sort of very odd things. Another one of the stories in this early series is a story called A Case of Identity, in which a woman consults Holmes because her boyfriend has mysteriously disappeared. And there is no crime at all that's been committed in the Blue Carbuncle. Of course, as readers will find out, there is, in fact, a crime. It just doesn't start that way.
Right. It's so interesting the way Holmes, Sherlock Holmes geeks go through all of this stuff. I hope you don't mind if I throw you into that group.
Proud of it.
One of your fellow geeks computed that no crime had taken place in a quarter of the total published cases in Sherlock Holmes stories. So this is something we see a lot of, I guess.
Yes, and again, I think, as we'll see particularly in this story, and I know we're going to talk about it a little later, this story is more about justice than about bringing a criminal to the legal defense, to the legal system.
There's not a lot of kind of – it's not so dark, this particular piece. Not a lot of foreboding. The stakes don't seem terribly high. It's kind of – is it something – a story that you would say is maybe more whimsical than some of the other stories?
In some respects, it depends on your perspective. The Countess of Morcar thinks that this is a high-stakes case.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
her beloved gem. Yeah. But I think that when we read the story, it's almost with a bit of amusement that we see the Countess. And the Countess, who is offered a high reward for this, is awfully excited about the loss of her gem. But as Holmes points out, the gem itself is really at fault for a lot of crime, for a long history of crime, and she should have known what she was getting into when she acquired this.
Yeah. All right. So give us a sort of a sketch, if you will, Leslie Kling. We'll talk more particularly as we go, but give us a sketch of the plot itself. Sort of lay out the story to the degree that you don't give too much away. Is that possible?
Sure. So Holmes, it's the second day after Christmas, Holmes is lounging about his apartment, perhaps recovering from a little jollification. We don't know. Watson drops by to wish him compliments of the season and finds Holmes puzzling over a battered old hat. And Holmes tells him that the hat has come with a goose, a surprise that his neighbor, Commissioner Peterson, commissioner is kind of a messenger, unofficial, you know, sort of concierge type. It's not a law enforcement person. The commissioner has found the goose and the hat on the streets of London, where a fracas has broken out and a man has dropped his hat and his goose. And he's brought this to Holmes to solve. And at this point, it seems to be just a trifling mystery involving the owner of the hat.
Yeah.
But the commissioner comes back to tell him that inside the goose, when his wife was cooking it, they found this incredible blue gem, the Blue Carbuncle. So now it becomes a matter of more pressing interest because Holmes recognizes this gem as the famous gem that was stolen from the Countess of Morcar only a day or two previously. She's advertised for it in the newspapers. She's offered a large reward for it. And now Holmes's mission is to trace how the gem got into the goose and perhaps by using the hat as the clue to solve the crime. So to solve this mystery. We don't know if it's a crime yet, but the mystery. And so they proceed around London to track down step by step the case. They eventually, in the end, as you said at the top, they do solve the crime. And we'll talk about the ending in a little bit.
Yeah. But we won't say too much about it, but we'll talk a bit about it. So I want to bring Matthew Ivan Bennett into the conversation. So what was your first impression of this story when you first read through it?
Well, obviously, when I first read through it, I saw a lot of comedy because the this draft, at least, is definitely dominated by that.
By humor.
Yeah. I've always seen that in Holmes too. And I don't know why specifically. Maybe it's more about the way that I personally relate to Holmes.
Yeah.
I think I knew Sherlock Holmes even before I knew Sherlock Holmes, and probably a lot of people can say that. But as a kid, I knew the image and the voice in the mind of Sherlock Holmes before I'd even read the stories, you know? And it appealed to me as a nerdy kid because it was a, you know, there was a superhero that used his mind,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. But you always thought there was something funny about it too.
I did, yeah. And I think it particularly came through Ryder. When I read through that scene and his reversal and the bumbling of it all, and I was thinking about translating this into 50 minutes of radio and looking at it and seeing, okay, you know, there's approximately 6,000 words here and this isn't going to fill 50 minutes. I've got to expand it. Where my mind went first.
Yeah. Was the funny part of it.
Yeah.
Is that unusual? Leslie Klinger, is that unusual? Do people look at these stories and sort of attach their own sensibility in that way? For some, they're really...
Of course.
Yeah, yeah.
Of course. And there's a wide range of the stories. Some of them are quite tragic. Some of them are very dark. I mean, nobody would find any real humor in The Hound of the Baskervilles. But I agree. This is part of what makes this story so charming is that... I'm not sure I'd use the word whimsical, but there's some very colorful characters.
Yes, certainly.
Windegate, Breckenridge, yeah. They're all, and Ryder himself, yeah. This sort of the bumbling person that he is. That's what's part of the charm of the story. So I must say, by the way, Matt, that I actually tried my own hand at a radio adaptation some time ago of this, in which I basically...
Of this show.
Kept all the dialogue. Yes. Kept all the dialogue, cut out all of the he said, she said stuff, and it didn't work at all. It's a lot harder than it looks.
Yeah, it's... Well, but you should also say, Matthew, that you used a lot of Leslie Klinger in getting the script put together.
Yes, I definitely should admit that to him because I did read the annotated your annotated version of it, which I quite liked. And,
well, thank you.
I really enjoyed it. And there was a lot of humor, and maybe that's what influenced me, because there was a lot of humor in your annotations, too. So.
I do try to keep a sort of lighter touch in those notes. Otherwise, they would just be deadly dull.
Yeah, yeah, speculating about Holmes having royal blood, I think, in one of them somewhere. And then, or you were quoting somebody else, I think. But I definitely did use many of your adaptations. As I reimagined this for myself, I actually changed Covent to Leadenhall and the Cosmopolitan to the Claridge and
why?
And specifically specified
that
it was a
set.
because
right,
they're accurate.
Right.
Yeah, I didn't mean any disrespect to Arthur Conan Doyle, but
Doyle did make a mistake about that. He, not the hotel name, but he had goose salesmen doing work at Covent Garden Market, which in fact didn't sell poultry. So Manson's quite right. He switched it to Leadenhall, where they did sell poultry.
I think I may be wrong, but I think I was even careful about my reference to the goose having a crop or not.
That's a wonderful. That's a wonderful. Point in itself.
Yeah. The several pages on that. I don't know if we want to get into that right now. Does a goose have a crop? Let me get a few more voices involved in the conversation. Cheryl Ann Clough is with us, Plan B Theater Company's managing director. She's directed all of the Radio Hour performances, including this one, which is the seventh radio drama in our partnership with the company anyway. Cheryl Ann, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
All right, we should say, you've got these two geeks, and you're a virgin, the Sherlock Holmes virgin.
Yes, I am. This is my first experience ever with Sherlock Holmes.
So, what
do you think?
Yeah, good question.
I really like it. You know, I was a little partial to our Halloween experience and everything scary.
Yeah.
But, and so I was a little reticent going in, but I'm really liking this story in particular and the warmth behind it. I think a good word that Leslie used was charm. It's definitely very charming. It's lighthearted. And the illustration of friendship that's in the story, I think, is really, really lovely and completely different from what we've done in the past and really suitable for the Christmas season.
Well, Leslie Klinger, it's one of the things that you really have said you like about it. You were mentioning earlier that it illustrates, there's that word that Shirley used, warmth, of that relationship between Watson and Holmes. Is that unusual to see that in a story like this?
It's unusual for the public to focus on. I don't think it's unusual. I think there are other stories where we see these elements. But sometimes in making entertainment products out of these stories, people have played that down. I don't want to – there's a whole long discussion we could have about Nigel Bruce and the travesty of the Universal films. But for example, I mean, my favorite scene in any Sherlock Holmes film ever made is in the first Robert Downey Jude Law film where Holmes, sitting in the carriage, says to Watson, a line straight out of Conan Doyle, "Watson, you have the grand gift of silence." And Watson looks at him and punches him in the nose.
Right.
And I thought, wow, they really got it, that these two, they were friends. They were close friends. They needed each other. And I think Matthew did a lovely job of expanding a little bit of the dialogue between Holmes and Watson and bringing that out.
Let me bring Bill Allred into the conversation. He plays Dr. Watson. He has also appeared in Radio Hour performances, the Radio Hour Alice. He's, of course, best known as being co-host of the Radio From Hell program on X96. Bill, welcome back.
Thanks, Doug.
So this Nigel Bruce was the image that first came to you.
Well, because that you never forget, as Whovians say, you never forget your first doctor.
Yeah.
And he was really my first Dr. Watson. Before I'd ever read the stories as a little kid, I saw the Basil Rathbone, Nigel Bruce movies. And to this day, in a certain way, Sherlock Holmes, Basil Rathbone is Sherlock Holmes to me, for sure.
Yeah.
But I was surprised then when I got a little older and began reading the stories that Dr. Watson wasn't a bumbling fool like Nigel Bruce, as Nigel Bruce portrayed him. I still have a bit of a fondness for that characterization, I have to say, but I was pretty astonished to find that Watson was a learned doctor. He was a very competent man, and he helped Sherlock Holmes and held his own in conversation. And you know, in the movies, you know, you remember Basil Rathbone, even though he had some affection for Dr. Watson, you could tell. At the same time, he was often quite irritated with Watson's bumbling.
Yeah, you know. Well, Leslie Klinger, you don't like that image. I mean, I guess this is a misimpression that we have about Watson.
I think it makes one wonder why a man like Holmes would choose to be friends with a fool. And I reject that. I think most of the us geeks do reject it. We did a poll recently for a symposium here at UCLA in which we asked people to vote on their favorite film, Watson, of all time. And in a surprising runaway, it was David Burke of the Granada television series, who really was the first to step up and play the intelligent, steadfast Watson. Really completely remaking the image of Watson. It wasn't just Burke. It was the script as well.
Yeah.
Bruce can't be blamed.
Yeah. No.
He did what he was told.
Sure.
Right. Exactly. What were you saying?
Well, he's got to be an anchor for Holmes.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Dramatically, anyway.
But
I hope we're going to talk about on this show, Doug, how you had the guts to play Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah, we might. Wait till you hear it. And we should say, I guess I want to prep people because we're going to do a scene when we get back from a break. But Cheryl, you decided let's not do accents. That's too tough, right?
Oh, well.
Not everyone has to, I guess.
Right. It wasn't.
Because I was ready with an accent when we came to the first rehearsal.
He was.
Yeah, it was a call I made as the director. And we just wanted to make sure that we got everything spot on, exactly right. And I think we're all familiar with the accents that we already have. Hopefully we're getting a little flavor of a British accent.
Yeah, yeah.
So
Leslie Klinger, that doesn't bother you, does it, or does it?
Not at all. Yeah. Holmes is universal at this point, immensely popular in Japan, of course, and many other countries. So as long as you weren't going to do a Transylvanian accent, any accent works for me.
Should have done that in Dracula. Leslie Klinger is with us. He is an expert on, as we said, two icons of the Victorian era and author of the three-volume set, The Annotated Sherlock Holmes, joining us today from the studios at UCLA in Los Angeles. Matthew Ivan Bennett here with us, created the adaptation of The Blue Carbuncle. Cheryl Ann Clough directs the production. Bill Allred plays Dr. Watson. We'll get to some of the other characters in the show when we get back from a break. On December 18th, that's a Tuesday night, Radio West and Plan B Theater Company is presenting Sherlock Holmes and the Blue Carbuncle. We're going to be at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center in Salt Lake City. There are going to be two performances, one at 7 and one at 8:30. The 7 o'clock performance will be broadcast live on KUER. For more details, you can visit our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about The Blue Carbuncle. It's our latest partnership with Plan B Theater Company. We're presenting a radio play of this Sherlock Holmes story. It's the only one set at Christmas time. We're going to be presenting it later this month in front of a live audience, and today we're giving you a preview. We have with us here in the studio Matthew Ivan Bennett. He's the editor, writer of, the creator of the adaptation, really, of The Blue Carbuncle for Plan B Theater Company. We have Cheryl Ann Clough is directing the production. Bill Allred plays Dr. Watson. Bill Allred from the X96 Radio from Hell team. And let me introduce two other characters here. Jay Perry is with us, plays several characters in the show. He has performed in every radio. Is that right?
Yes.
Every radio hour, as well as a lot of other Plan B Theater productions. Welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Thank you.
Jason Tatum is with us, performing in his first radio hour. Though he's been in a number of Plan B Theater productions, plays a number of characters as well in The Blue Carbuncle. Jason, welcome to you.
Thank you very much.
So let me just get your impressions, Jason and Jay, of the show, sort of the pacing, what you made of it, what you make of it now.
Well, it's you said the pacing. I mean, we were talking before the break about just sort of how much fun this script is, and the pacing of it is very, very quick, just like all great comedy. It's a lot of fun. It moves right along, and we have a really good time, sort of becoming the environment for this world.
Plus, to go along with the pacing. On the radio, they don't get to see all the brilliant physical stuff we do. So you just right. have to shut up and talk,
right.
if you can say it that way.
Right. I wanted to get your sense of – Jason, you were something of a Sherlock Holmes fan. Were you not? Have you been or is this one of your first encounters with
Sherlock Holmes? I read a lot of the stories as a kid. Not a huge Holmes fan, but a huge – radio drama fan.
Yeah.
As a chubby little kid growing up in Utah, with really nothing else to do on Saturday nights, I just love the idea of being able to, you know, turn off the lights and sit down and get lost in a story, you know. And it was just amazing. I remember thinking I'd been born in the wrong time, you know, because we had TV easily accessible and movies anytime you wanted to. But, you know, I would imagine myself growing up in the 30s, just, you know, sitting on the living room carpet, just listening to the radio until 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. Wow. It was great. I loved it.
Leslie Klinger, I guess the story lends itself pretty well to radio, don't you think?
Absolutely. And I wanted to mention that Holmes adaptations, there's over 700 that have been done for the radio right. over the years. Very, very popular in the 30s and the 40s. And, of course, Rathbone and Bruce, about whom we were speaking earlier, had a long-running show until Rathbone dropped out and then other people played Holmes with Bruce.
Matthew, you've talked about the fact that one of the things you like about Holmes, you were mentioning, was just his use of logic, you know, and the use of his intellect.
But oh, yeah.
I think the thing that's interesting about it, though, is sort of that that on one hand, it's all about logic. But as you've said, and I wanted to sort of dry out on this, it's not just about logic, that there's a hunch in there as well, that he can't guarantee everything. He just sort of makes a leap at some point.
Yeah, there is. There is, which I think might be called expert intuition. Around the time I was writing this, I read a fascinating book by Daniel Kahneman, who's the psychologist who won the Nobel Prize for Economics a few years ago. He wrote this book called Thinking Fast and Slow. And it's about our two mental systems. And system one is our intuitive, and system two is really our rational system. And they aren't physically different. They physically overlap in the brain, but they're two different modes that we have. And there's a whole chapter devoted to a lot of the book outlines the pitfalls of system one and all of the biases that we fall into when we rely on that. But there is a chapter about expert intuition. And I think that that Holmes typifies that. He's so experienced that he can look at, and this is, I think, in a scandal in Bohemia. Like, he can look at Watson's shoe and he can see scores on the bottom of the shoe, and he knows that he's been in bad weather recently and that he has, you know, a bad servant. at the same time, and he's right. And I guess on the one hand, that was Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Just creating expert intuition, but it really does exist. It's a real thing, as Daniel Kahneman says. And so, when I first read these stories, I did have an odd geeky attraction to Sherlock Holmes. I wanted to be Sherlock Holmes. I think a lot of people who read these stories do, and that potential is in all of us. And it really did inspire me when I read the books to go out and learn more about that side of my brain and to learn about logic. I went out and I read about logical fallacies, and I memorized logical fallacies. And I still, to this day, I love reading. It's nerdy, but I love reading about biases and fallacies and like analyzing news stories and picking those out.
I wonder, Leslie Klinger, in this particular story, Holmes, as you've said, demonstrates this capacity for deduction and observation. Do all the stories have that, though? You know, like
no,
the facts
they
are these
don't.
And he lays them out.
Right. They don't. It would be a boring one-note saga if we just saw the thinking machine all the time. We don't. We see stubborn tracking down of clues that doesn't require great deductive leaps. This story also has, by the way, shrewd psychological insights as well as deductions from clues, the wonderful scene with Breckenridge, and where Holmes knows which buttons to push to
right.
get what he wants.
Mm. Right. Mm. Based on the football scores that he's got.
Yeah. Well, there's a scene. Cheryl, help us set this particular scene up that we're going to read this morning, if you would.
Right. Well, Leslie already gave us a really good description of the story overall. But for this scene, we're at the point in the story where Holmes and Watson are trying to find out how the jewel was found, became, or was put into the goose,
yeah.
and who did it. And so they head out to the streets to find the owner of the goose, and their first clue leads them to a public house or a pub called the Alpha, and they know that the goose was recently purchased from the owner of the Alpha.
Now, we had some technical problems today, so we're not able to do a lot of the effects, which is something you can expect and wait for a little bit later, I suppose. But anything else to say about the scene, Matthew?
Well, it's a scene in which, in my rendering of the story anyway, that Holmes is not at the top of his game. He's probably a little bit too pushy, and we see some bromantic tension, if you will, between between Watson and Holmes.
Right. Here's a scene then from Sherlock Holmes and the Blue Carbuncle.
It was a bitter night, so we drew on our ulsters and wrapped cravats about our throats. Outside, the stars shone coldly in a cloudless sky, and the breath of the passers-by blew out into smoke like so many pistol shots. My friend's feet, it seemed, had invisible wings, despite his ailing lungs. I struggled to stay apace as my shoes rang out crisply and loudly down Oxford Street. Within 20 minutes, we were in the Bloomsbury at the Alpha, a public house possessed of a distinctly plebeian elegance. Leading our tour, as always, Holmes thrust open the door, startling the half-conscious tippler at a nearby table.
Fascinating. Two glasses, barkeep, frothy and frigid. Your beer should be excellent if it is as good as your geese.
My geese?
The reed-thin proprietor was as bewildered as he was drunk. His eyes bugged into uncertainty as he scratched and twirled at the tussock of white hair sprouting from his Adam's apple. Holmes plowed on.
Yes, I was speaking only a half an hour ago to Mr. Henry Baker, who was a member of your illustrious Goose Club.
That's so. You know Art Luck Henry, then.
Henry!
Quiet!
Yes, we were old pals. Knew him before the Art Luck. So again, the old boy was bragging about your geese.
Ducks. The ducks.
Well, duck. You see, duck. Them's not duck. Our geese, duck. Sir.
Geese! Run, Henry!
I said quiet. So, them's not our geese. Not official-like.
Indeed. Whose, then? I must know the supplier. I simply must. Please.
Well, I get the 24 from a salesman in Leadenhall Market. You want the house beer?
On the house.
Muffle your gob, Ted. So, the house beer?
Your best. Please. And by the way, I know some of them. Which was it?
Sorry?
Which was it?
Which was what?
What was the name of the salesman? I am rather well regarded by many of the salesmen.
You're a bit of a wagon chin, ain't you?
Oh, you haven't the slightest.
He knows it.
He's information vegetable, animal, and mineral.
Oh. Knows the kings of England and quotes the fights historical.
So. From Marathon to Waterloo in order categorical.
So.
Very well acquainted too with matters mathematical. He understands equations both the simple and quadratical.
Yes, I do. So amusing. And, you know, I was discussing binomial theorems with a salesman from Leadenhall the other day.
Do tell.
Go on.
Well, it was a side splitter. My mercantile friend insisted that the binomial coefficients appear in the golden triangle when, of course, it is Pascal's.
Everybody knows that.
Indeed. And such was my joke to the fellow. So, what was the salesman's name?
How should I know?
You purchased your geese from the man.
Oh, him! Brecken. Brecken something. Anything else?
I don't know him. Well, here's to your good health, barman, and prosperity to your house. Good night.
You're going
to
pay for that? Hey!
My apologies, sir. He can be a bit single-minded. This ought to cover it. Happy Christmas.
Oh, yeah. Happy Christmas.
I am a very modern Major General.
Shut it.
And scene.
There it is. Scene from the Blue Carbuncle, the play adapted by Matthew Ivan Bennett. You know, you keep hearing Leslie Klinger in these streets and place names and things like that, and I'm wondering, do the Holmes geeks go out and find these places, and do they exist?
Oh, yes. And actually, one of the lovely challenges is to figure out the original of the Alpha. We know that it was, quote, across from the British Museum. My favorite is the Plough, which is right there. There's also the Museum Tavern. They'll both do. I've taken my picture at both of them and have. But it's absolutely a compulsion to do this. I like, by the way, how Matthew brought Gilbert and Sullivan in. It's interesting that nowhere in any of the stories is there any mention of Gilbert and Sullivan, and I've often wondered why.
Mm. Yeah, that information, vegetable, animal, and mineral line.
What is like Stowe Holmes, right? Yeah. Is that it?
Well, it came unbidden when I was writing it. I was just focusing on the tension between them, and I had to stop and look it up. I had to make sure, whether the H. Miss Spinafore had been written before or after this. And I stopped, and luckily it was. And then I just ran with it. Right. Then this morning, I realized as I was looking over the scene that the HMS Pinafore was the second play that I've ever done. I did it in the fifth grade, and and I wonder if that's why it was just simply stored somewhere back there.
Well, Leslie, it worked for you, right?
It did.
So there's a moment in the story where Holmes makes this kind of decidedly unscientific conclusion about the intellect of a man by the size of his hat. I mean, this hat is really large, and Holmes concludes that, you know, smart people must have big brains and therefore, you know, big hats, I guess. This was a kind of a common idea at the time, I guess.
Yes. Cubic capacity, as Holmes puts it, a matter of cubic capacity.
Yeah.
Yes, it was a common notion that large brains meant more thinking capacity. Of course, ridiculous now, we know, but certainly maybe Holmes was just thinking ahead to the computer age when extra RAM did some good.
but that misconception did survive for quite a while, didn't it?
Yes.
I still think it's true. Isn't it? You can't disabuse me of that. I have a very large head, and I know that I'm quite bright.
Well, it was part of a sort of broader scientific focus on such wonderful things as bumps on the head, which was a very serious science. But also, again, the broader idea that physiognomy dictated character. You could tell criminals by the way they looked. They had sort of atavistic throwback characteristics, you know, they looked sort of primitive and all that. And it was a whole Victorian idea that appearance had a good deal to do with character.
Mm. J. Perry, talk a little bit about Ryder, wonderful, bumbling, panicky figure who appears later on in the piece.
Well, that does bring up Ryder because he's described as sort of a rat-faced fellow, you know, that really helped me a lot to just kind of figure out, oh God, what kind of guy is this? Well, he's a rat-faced guy. He's a criminal who ends up sort of being a victim of his own stupidity. And you know, sort of along the way thinks that he's figured this whole thing out, but he really turns out to be someone completely different than the way he looks, I think, than the way that he's originally seen, I think, by the people that or at least by, you know, by me the first time I read him, and I read Rat Faced and then got to the end when he, you know, sort of, well, we won't give that away, but something changes, and he has sort of an unexpected sort of a response at the end.
And Holmes has figured him out, Leslie Klinger, right? I mean, is this the psychological part of this story?
Yes. I think, you know, it's important to see that Ryder is sort of a victim himself. There's a woman, and she's coerced Ryder into cooperating with the crime. We have the clear sense that this is the first time he's done it, and perhaps the last time he ever will. But
here's an email. Let me read from Benjamin. Actually, it's an email from our producer Benjamin. You could have just walked this in. When Leslie Klinger appeared on the show last year, he mentioned The Blue Carbuncle was perhaps his favorite Sherlock adventure. That endorsement inspired my girlfriend and I to read the story together at Christmas time, and we really enjoyed the tale, and we were inspired by it to actually get our own geese to raise for a feast during the holidays. Wow. And we now have four American buff geese squawking in our backyard. Thanks, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, and thanks, Leslie. We have you to blame.
Well, the geese are not very happy about this, I suspect, because they know that they're going to suffer, as Holmes says, the fate of geese.
The fate of geese. That's exactly right. Which sort of brings us, I guess, to the kind of the idea that There is a moment that just sort of hangs there with Ryder and Holmes. You know, he can either turn him in or he can offer him kind of a sense of redemption. Yeah. And I don't know how much we want to give away Leslie Klinger, but I do want to talk about – it sort of goes back to that theme that you were mentioning earlier, a theme in Holmes' stories where there's more of an interest in justice than an interest in sort of the, you know, the legalities of it all.
Yes, I think that one of the great mysteries in all of the Holmes stories is why does Holmes do it? What drives him to be the person that he is, consumed by a passion for solving mysteries, but even more importantly, consumed by a passion for justice and bringing wrongdoers to justice, but not necessarily to the courts. This is, I think, a critical element in understanding Holmes's character. When I was the technical advisor for the Robert Downey films, and I know that this aspect of Holmes really fascinated Robert Downey. He and I had several conversations about this. This inner mystery at the core of Holmes's character. What is it that's wound him up? We don't know. We never learn in the story sort of what happened to set Holmes off on this path. Hmm.
You know, it seems like he has to – and you sort of see this at the end of the story where he has to – he has no identity if he's not searching for something or doing something. I mean, that's part of – he can't be bored, it seems. He can't just sit back and relax almost.
I think that's true, that he is – some people have shrewdly suggested that he suffered Asperger's syndrome or was bipolar, and that this is something in his character, that he's just he needs constant stimulation. But it's much more than that. If it was only that, there are many things he could have done to just be stimulating. He could have played video games, or he could have, solved crossword puzzles or the like. So this is very specific to justice.
Yeah, or taking more cocaine.
Mm. Yeah. Right. It's like he's trying to avoid thinking about other things sometimes, I think.
Huh.
You know, he's
the American
he doesn't really want to think about, you know, Irene Adler. He wants to push that out of his mind as much as he can. And other things in his life as I read through some of the stories, he kind of avoids the emotionality and I think very purposely. Avoids
absolutely. This is a man who is, with the large exception of Watson, friendless.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Leslie Klinger, the editor of the new annotated Sherlock Holmes, Matthew Ivan Bennett created the adaptation of The Blue Carbuncle. Cheryl Ann Clough directs Plan B Theater Company Sherlock Holmes and The Blue Carbuncle. Bill Allred is Dr. Watson. Jay Perry, Jason Tatum play several characters in the radio drama. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our pleasure.
Pleasure.
For being with us. Tuesday, December 18th, Plan B Theater Company and Radio West presenting The Adventure of the Blue Carbuncle as adapted by Matthew. It's going to be at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center in downtown Salt Lake City. There's going to be two performances, one at 7 and one at 8:30. The 7 o'clock performance will be broadcast live here on KUER. For the details, you can visit our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard, Elaine Clark. Thanks to Michael Havey, Louis Downey. I'm Doug Fabrizio.